Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Thursday, the 28th of August. We continue our coverage of the Democratic National Convention, and let me just tell you the rundown in case you don't know it by now. We're covering On Point with Tom Ashbrook, who is live in Denver the first hour of the time we would normally be with you, and then we're with you the second hour to speak with a number of wonderful people about what they're seeing in Denver and their analysis of this Democratic National Convention. Next week, we do the same for the Republican National Convention starting on Monday. We have two wonderful guests with us. E.J. Dionne will be joining us momentarily. He wrote it last night. I knew from the moment I met Bill Clinton in 1987 that he would be president someday. This was a common experience among people who met Clinton in the late 70s and 80s. And all the talent that I saw then was on display last night as he spoke before the Democratic National Convention. This is also such a significant day in American history when it was the anniversary of the I Have a Dream speech by Dr. Martin Luther King. Walter Mondale last night on public television was talking about the 1964 convention and how Senator Barack Obama may not have been allowed in the door 44 years ago as the convention debated whether to seat black delegates from Mississippi at the convention. So we'll talk a bit about how important this day is in American history and what came before this day. And welcome your phone calls. Please join us as early as you would like. We want to take, I know many of you want to talk about the convention, so please call at 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. If you're in Milwaukee, it's 414-227-2050, 414-227-2050. E.J. Dionne, who's on a very busy schedule, as you can imagine, we're delighted to have with us, columnist for The Washington Post, author of Sold Out, Reclaiming Faith in Politics After the Religious Right, senior fellow at the Brookings Institution, longtime contributor to National Public Radio. It's always a delight to hear him. And he's with us the first part of our program. Later, we'll be speaking with the professor and chair at the Department of Political Science at the University of Colorado. E.J. Dionne, thank you so much for being with us.
Always a joy to be with you.
Yeah, it's great to have you here. Could you tell me, because I was watching all of this, I'm watching hour after hour on television, I was so struck by the emotional reaction when the nomination came to the convention, unanimous decision to go with Senator Barack Obama, particularly by young and older African-Americans on the floor. It was such a moment in American history, wasn't it?
Well, I am so glad you opened the show that way with your introduction, because in all of the tit-for-tat over celebrity and Paris Hilton and all of that, we've totally lost how important this is. This morning I went back and reread Hubert Humphrey's amazing civil rights speech 60 years ago. This year, in 1948, civil rights split the Democratic Party. Several Southern state delegations walked out. This had been, the Democrats, had been the party of segregation, at least in the South. And so to have Barack Obama win the Democratic Party nomination 60 years after that great battle over civil rights is really an extraordinary thing. And I think, in a way, the imperative for Obama is to restore the sense of historic moment that's kind of been lost here in all of the tit-for-tat, the Clinton dramas, celebrity Paris Hilton, all this stuff. I think his job tonight is to kind of reclaim this as a big election, not a small election. And my hunch is that a small election he may well lose, and a big election he probably wins. But you're right, and you can feel it. I mean, it is a remarkable feeling to the sense of pride and accomplishment that you can sort of sense in talking to African-American delegates. And it is something very special. And I hope whatever happens, and whether people are for or against Obama, that extraordinary change in our country isn't lost on people.
Mm-hmm. I was listening to NPR this morning, and they were talking about the fact that 45 years ago, the Washington Senators, was it then, Major League Baseball games had been canceled. They were worried about riots. Secretaries were sent home from work in Washington, D.C. because there were concerns they would be raped.
Right. I mean, you just said it. I mean, this is just something very special. I mean, the intriguing thing, of course, is there is the sense of historic moment, And then there is the very practical task that Obama also has to carry out here, which is we do know that a chunk of white, lower middle class, working class swing voters may well want to vote for change, are probably in a mood to vote for change, but are trying to figure out not only who Barack Obama is, but as a Democratic congressman put it to me recently, whether he gets them. Congressman Joe Sestak from suburbs of Philadelphia said the issue isn't really who Obama is, it's whether people know that he knows them. And I think that's his other purpose tonight. So it's a kind of linkage between this sort of historic moment and the very practical concerns people have that the president they elect understands the struggles they have. I thought that Bill Clinton's speech last night and Joe Biden's speech really started to make that case. I mean, the Clinton speech sort of reminded you of the Clinton magic, I thought, last time. Maybe I'm a sucker for the Clinton magic. But, you know, what's interesting about Bill Clinton's speeches, as a friend of mine said once, is they're not simply rhetoric. Clinton always makes an argument in his speeches. And, boy, I think there was a huge sigh of relief in the Obama camp at the end of that Bill Clinton speech, and they were probably wishing they had gotten some of it into primetime television.
Interesting. Right, yeah. You wrote last night, I knew from the moment you met Bill Clinton in 87 that he would be president someday. Did you feel the same way about Senator Obama? I don't know when you met him, but
yes,
did you have the same feel?
It's funny you ask that because I've been doing this particular something like I'm doing now for about 22 years, I guess. And in that period, there were only three people I can say that I knew from the moment I met them, I knew they were going to rise very far. And the first is surprising, given my own politics, who's Newt Gingrich, whom I met in 1986.
Really?
And I thought there was something extraordinary about this person. Bill Clinton I met in 87 and came home, and I remember telling my wife, the man's going to be president. Won't be this time, but it's going to happen. And the third was Barack Obama, whom I met 11 years ago as part of a series of seminars on social capital that Bob Putnam, whom you probably had on your show, famous for his book Bowling Alone, had organized. And you could tell that there was a certain, there was a kind of intelligence to Obama, but also this great capacity to sort of listen and respond. So, yeah, I have this little pantheon, Gingrich, Clinton, and Obama. And So far, I think I got it more or less right, but we'll see.
You'll see. I was interested in this letter to the editor in the New York Times, my apologies, this morning from a woman, and I just thought it was interesting. I'm a Democrat who never liked Senator Hillary Rodham Clinton. I'm a staunch supporter of Senator Barack Obama. On Tuesday night, Mrs. Clinton graduated from politician to stateswoman after her convention speech, "All is forgiven. I love Hillary Clinton." Did she do that for a lot of former Clinton supporters, do you think?
You mean former, you mean Obama supporters?
For Clinton supporters who have been reluctant to go to Obama, that they all of a sudden now will follow her advice and they love her and the Obama, yes.
I think that, first of all, my sense, I was speaking to a Clinton delegate, yesterday or the day before, who said, look, there are three quarters of the Clinton delegates are already with Obama. She figured there were about a quarter who were still having trouble getting over to Obama.
Mm-hmm.
In the electorate, the poll suggests that, say, a fifth of the Clinton primary voters, or at least people who say they were Clinton primary supporters, are now supporting John McCain. I think for a certain group of Clinton supporters, that was enough. But that group, my hunch is, we're going to get to Obama anyway. I think there's another group of people who voted for Clinton, partly because they were voting against Obama, partly because they weren't persuaded that Obama was ready to be president. I think only Obama can win those voters. Clinton made it easier. Clinton kind of cleared a path for Obama, but he's the person who's going to have to close the deal.
Let's go to phone calls. Our lines are all filled, but keep trying. 800-486-8655. EJ Dionne is with us for the first part of this show, joining us live from Denver, and he's been writing extensively about this election. We start our calls with Guy from Milwaukee. Hello, Guy.
Hi, how are you doing?
Fine, how are you?
Thank you for the call. Thank you for taking the call.
Sure.
I had a quick question. What's been going on this last eight years of debacle have been the fact that we haven't had truth. We haven't had truth in media. We have no outlet for truth. And what I'm wondering is, when Obama changes things up a bit, if we can have an outlet for truth, fairness in media, because I know Ronald Reagan did away with all that.
There's a lot there. I'm not quite sure how to respond to that. First of all, I don't think you could talk about media anymore because, when people say media, they're often talking about what the bloggers call the mainstream media.
Mm-hmm.
And there is so much media out there. My own job at this convention, for example, is very different than it was even 4 years ago because I am not only writing my column as usual and getting the chance to do National Public Radio work every night, but I'm also sort of posting blog items, which many of which are like brief columns, and you've got a whole tent here full of bloggers putting out their point of view, doing some of their own reporting, and so I'm all for the truth. I think that I guess one of the things I worry about is that the new technologies have an enormous capacity to spread information around quickly. They have a very helpful capacity to criticize instantly and call into question anything that those of us in the traditional media write. That's all to the good. But they've also made more efficient, the spreading of things that are untrue. For example, famously, Barack Obama is supposedly a Muslim when we know he's not a Muslim.
Mm-hmm.
I think that... The struggle for truth will go on, and in a much more complicated environment. In the end, I think there are more checks and balances out there because of the proliferation of new media, and I think on the whole, that is a very good thing.
Thanks very much, Guy, for your call. Let's go to Dale from Milwaukee next. Hi, Dale.
How are you doing?
All right. How are you?
I'm very good, thank you.
Good.
EJ, I love your columns. Sometimes they're in the Journal Sentinel, I think, when they get syndicated. I appreciate the work you do.
Well, thank you so much.
No problem. The comment I wanted to make, I was a Hillary Clinton supporter. I think Bill Clinton obviously reminded us, of his oratory skills. Obama's got some of those qualities. I guess I'm still having a problem with the fact that, during the primary and fairly recently, Bill Clinton still saying that he doesn't think Obama can lead. So in your view, did that speech last night, all of a sudden in the matter of a couple of weeks or a month, now he can lead? And Joe Biden kind of said the same thing. I know he was going for president at that time, so candidates will say certain things that they have to say at the time. Maybe now, their opinions have changed. But to me, it still kind of seems like a lot of theater. And with some of the other stories in the comments that Clinton was just making the other day about, you've got a candidate who you might agree with half the time but can actually deliver, or you got a candidate that you agree with almost all the issues on, but he can't deliver. There's still those comments out there, and I just feel that, was it more of a show, or was it sincere?
I suppose your skepticism is justified in the sense that, yes, in politics, people do what they feel they have to do in a given moment, and it was very clear that Bill Clinton's task was to go all the way over to Obama. But I tell you, what struck me about that speech is that Clinton went much farther than I guess I expected him to in saying that, Obama is ready to be president. There was nothing half-hearted in that Clinton's speech. I suppose somebody will find some half-hearted sentence in there, but I sure didn't see that speech in that light. And it's true, all those words from the primaries are going to come back. It's worth remembering that the first President Bush, when he ran against Ronald Reagan, called Reagan's program voodoo economics. I actually thought he got it right the first time. Nonetheless, he didn't have a problem supporting voodoo economics when he was the running mate to Ronald Reagan. So this is fairly typical. For voters who have doubts about Obama, again, all the endorsements in the world will not solve that. Only Obama can reassure those folks who are skeptical about his readiness. But I was struck in a number of the speeches that the Democratic speakers were trying to say, look, John McCain has had a lot of experience, he's been around for a long time, but on this issue, that issue, and the other issue, Obama was right and McCain was wrong. That was a rhetorical device that you've heard all through this convention. And I think that's going to have to be Obama's argument, that if you're just voting on the basis of long experience, obviously McCain's been around longer. It's a question of who do you think will make the right calls, and that's the core Democratic argument. And if Obama makes it, he'll win, and if he fails to make that, he may not win.
EJ, we've been talking about this a little bit in the office. Heavens knows we don't want this to happen. It's horrendous to think that it could, but we have a major hurricane that could hit the Gulf of Mexico. Heaven forbid it should hit New Orleans again, but there's talk of evacuating that city. We talk about international events influencing political elections. What about an event like that where you may have to evacuate this city that we have these horrendous images of being hit 3 years ago?
I guess anything that gets the word Katrina in the news a lot cannot be helpful to the Republican Party. I mean, you know, we look at the polls. It's worth noting that one of the reasons John McCain is doing better than a Republican might do in the current circumstances, given the country's backlash against the Republicans, is that he hasn't been president for 8 years. There was a poll done that showed if this race were Barack Obama versus George Bush, Obama would win by 20 points. You know, so that the Republicans, I think, have managed to nominate the candidate who probably has the best shot of winning an election, which is exceedingly, you know, which under all circumstances would be very difficult for the Republicans to win. It's why the Democrats are trying to blur any distinction between John McCain and George Bush. I guess it was Joe Biden who said he had a Freudian slip when he mentioned Bush instead of McCain. That was a kind of political slip. But yes, I take your premise. I think anything that gets Katrina and what happened, that was really the beginning of the end of President Bush's popularity. Mm-hmm. And so, yes, I share the newsroom, your newsroom view that this cannot help the Republicans.
Right. One more phone call, and then we'll let you go to your many other tasks. Frank,
thank you.
Frank from Madison, hi.
Hello.
Hi.
Thank you. You're a very fine guest today, as always. May I ask the guest whether, to an extent, this is still an artificial event? Has the Democratic Party and Barack Obama displayed any willingness to face up to where the country is economically, in terms of its relations with the rest of the world, what America has actually done? And is there any attempt conceivable on the part of a new Obama administration to face the markets, or are they going to go along with sort of socializing markets rather than restraining them?
That's a very learned question, sir. I think, first of all, conventions have become artificial events. You know, once upon a time, conventions selected nominees. Now they are an occasion for a party to make an extended argument to a very large audience. Now, that's not unimportant. It's just different from what conventions started out as in our history. I get a sense that there is a developing kind of consensus on the progressive side of politics that is that says there are great benefits to markets that we do not want to lose, but that we are in a period where we've learned that completely unregulated and unconstrained markets can produce outcomes that are bad. I think that the deregulation of banking turned out to have all kinds of consequences that were negative, and that we're going to revisit banking regulation next year, no matter who is elected president. I think we've seen an economy that has grown without increasing incomes in the middle or at the bottom. Indeed, the number of people in poverty has been going up. And so I think you're seeing, you know, on the Democratic Party in particular, but on the progressive side generally, an effort to figure out how do you rebalance market forces on the one hand and necessary government interventions without which markets will just fly off the rails. You know, I've heard a number of Democrats here remind us that FDR saved capitalism from itself. And I think if we're in another of those moments where if you believe in markets, you're also going to have to believe in a sensible role of government to make markets work.
EJ, we'll anxiously await what you have to say about tonight's big speech.
Well, thank you so much.
Thank you.
It's very good to be with you.
Yeah, great always to have you with us. EJ Dionne, our guest the first part of this hour, joining us by phone from Denver. He's a syndicated columnist for The Washington Post, author of a number of books, most recently Sold Out, Reclaiming Faith in Politics After the Religious Right. We are going to pause for just a moment, and then we'll return, take more of your phone calls, and our guest joining us from Colorado, Professor Kenneth Bickers, professor and chair of the Department of Political Science at the University of Colorado. Our phone number remaining 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Milwaukee callers 414-227-2050. Thanks for your call, Frank. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Kathleen Dunn. Just a reminder that next week we will be examining the Republican National Convention out of St. Paul and doing the same kind of format. Tom Ashbrook, the first hour, will be with you the second hour from Wisconsin. And joining us this part of the show is Professor Kenneth Bickers. He is professor and chair of the Department of Political Science at the University of Colorado. He received his PhD. It's amazing how many people have Wisconsin ties. He received his PhD from the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He's the author of a number of books and articles and journals, and his current research is focusing on the consequences of the devolution of federal policy activities to states and local communities, a book in progress tentatively titled America's Post-Entitlement Employment Policies is soon to be published, and we'll get him on the air when that book is published. Welcome to your phone calls, as we always do. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. Should you want to send an email, I forgot about the email, send the email at talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org, and we'll be happy to hear from you. Many of you want to speak politics today, understandably so. Professor Kenneth Bickers, hello. Thank you so much for being with us.
Hi, Kathleen. It's nice to be here. It's a beautiful day here in Colorado, isn't it?
It isn't here in Milwaukee, but
it's... Oh, I'm sorry. I thought you were here in Denver.
No, I wish we were, actually.
Oh, I'm sorry.
No, we're in Milwaukee.
Yeah, well, I love Wisconsin. I spent many happy, hardworking years in Wisconsin, and it's nice to talk to you this morning.
I noticed that. It's amazing how many people have that Wisconsin connection. So it's quite a night today. I must say I'm just struck by the historic nature of tonight. Be you a Republican, be you a Democrat, whatever you are, just the fact that when you look at America's history, when you look at the fact that this is the anniversary of the I Have a Dream speech, there is so much symbolic significance and importance to this day in American history, don't you think?
I do. This is quite a remarkable day. What Hillary said the other night about 88 years since the constitutional amendment giving women suffrage, and as well as the anniversary of the I Have a Dream speech. This is a historic day.
Mm-hmm. I can't imagine what it will be like to get all those people at this Invesco Field. He's expecting, what, 75,000 people? Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, it's. I think it's going to be crowded, and I think it's going to be noisy, and it'll be a boisterous crowd, I'm guessing.
Right. And does that influence the kind of speech that he will give tonight? So much has been written about his cool, that he's intellectual guy. Early on, he was compared to Adlai Stevenson, being too heady, et cetera. But he can also rouse a very large crowd, can't he?
Well, I think the comparison might be better to Bill Clinton, actually, in the speech that he gave just last night, the way he thrives off the energy of the crowd. And and it's not just what he says. It's the involvement with the crowd and the way he feeds off of the energy of the crowd. I think Obama has much the same, and maybe in some ways even more, the ability to take a crowd and work the crowd through his speech making.
Right. Will there be a huge traffic jam getting to this field, or is that all worked out?
I don't think it's so much getting to it. I think the unsung traffic jam is the one getting away from it afterwards. They are telling people to arrive early. It's a beautiful day here. It's absolutely clear and fairly cool today. It's still in the 60s. It might be up in the 70s by now. But they're telling people to arrive early in the afternoon. So they'll be trickling into the stadium and going through the security. That'll take them a while. After the speech, they don't have to clear security, and they're not going to be trickling out. They're going to be pouring out. So I think that's actually
right.
Where the traffic jam is going to occur.
Right. Let's spend a little bit more time on former President Clinton's speech last night, beginning with the incredible ovation that he received. It just went on and on and on, didn't it? What did that mean?
Well, I think it's a sign of how much affection there still is for him. I'm sure it's personal, but also that he is an icon in the Democratic Party. He's the only elected president to be reelected to the presidency since Franklin Roosevelt on the Democratic side, and so that's a lesson not lost on the delegates. And I think part of it was a show of their affection for his success in winning elections for the Democratic Party.
Mm-hmm. Can we talk a little bit about Senator Biden's speech and start with the introduction by his son, Beau, who's about to be deployed to Iraq? I thought he gave him a wonderful introduction, and I'm wondering, I thought his speech was a little more low-key than I expected from Biden. And maybe in front of a huge hall it seemed low-key to me, but it was more personal than you usually hear from him. It wasn't quite the fighter, I think, that we expected, but it was a good speech.
I thought it was a pretty good speech. Biden had a hard task, not the least of which is that he was following Bill Clinton.
Right.
And no one wants to do that, and probably not even Barack Obama tonight wants to do that, although I'm sure he'll happily be doing it tonight. But Biden's speech, I thought, had to do several things. While he's been in politics for a long, long, long time, he really isn't all that well known to Americans in general. He's reasonably well known among Democratic Party activists and those Democrats that participated in the early caucuses and primaries when he was still a candidate. But part of what he needed to do and what his son was doing for him was to introduce him. And then he needed to make the case for Obama and to make the case against McCain. And so those are a lot of things to do all in one speech. I think it was a good speech. He didn't pull the audience in the same way that Bill Clinton did.
Mm-hmm.
The back and forth when he got into the kind of chant mode toward the end of the speech, he just never quite did that. I think that's a sign. You know, some people have the gift, and most of us don't.
Mm-hmm.
So, but it was a good speech.
Yeah, it was quite a gift. A lot of attention paid from Biden and particularly Hillary Clinton on the state of the economy. Biden talking about his dad, champ, when you get knocked down, get up. Talking about his blue-collar roots, not forgetting those. There seems to be, and I'm wondering how necessary this is and important it is to a Democratic victory, to really get at the heart level to those blue-collar workers.
Well, I think what they're doing is they're responding to survey data that are fairly clear and consistent in this, which is that Obama has not done has not been particularly strong in reaching to some important constituencies within the Democratic Party.
Mm-hmm.
This doesn't mean that Obama isn't enthusiastically supported by others. He certainly is, but there's a portion of the Democratic Party that also extends into voters that are not, they may lean Democrat, they may actually lean Republican, but they're independents, that Obama has not done particularly well with. And those were voters that were much more likely to be voting for Hillary, especially in those late primaries that Obama was not winning and that she was winning.
Let's go to phone calls. We have a number of people who want to comment on what they've heard and seen from the convention. 800-486-8655 is our number, 414-227-2050 in Milwaukee. And if you'd like to send an email, do that at talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. Our guest is Professor Kenneth Bickers, professor and chair, Department of Political Science, University of Colorado. And we start with Mike from Appleton. Hi, Mike.
Yes, good morning. I'd like to ask the professor the following. I think I belong to the part of the electorate that's probably going to decide this election. I'm white, middle class, sort of. I call myself a faded white collar because I've had to take on extra jobs just to make ends meet. Mm. And so now I look at, you know, this panorama, and I have Obama and I have McCain. I like Obama. I think he's very personal. I like Joe Biden. But I'm really skeptical. You know, I don't know. I was Republican. I'm firmly independent now. I really don't pay any attention to the nonsense of the speeches or the nonsense that's said about Obama being, you know, Muslim and all of that. I'm trying to make a hard decision. You know, who is going to, you know, let's take it down to the nuts and bolts. Which of these two people in the long run is going to benefit me more?
Yeah, this is an important point, and I think you're right that it's you and a lot of other folks out there like you that are going to decide the election in the end. One of the things that this is way away from your particular situation, but the models that political scientists have developed over the last 15, 20 years for forecasting presidential election results, the one set of variables in those models that consistently do the best job of predicting, and in fact, these models do a pretty good job. They're not perfect, but they do a pretty good job of predicting the final vote. The key variables are economic conditions and whether there has been job growth, the amount of income that people have that's left over after the effects of inflation that reduces purchasing power. And people's sense of their economic futures. Those variables really dominate the model, and the way that plays out, sounds like for the caller, is if things are good, typically the incumbent and the incumbent party is credited with those good things. If things are bad from the point of view of voters, then typically the incumbent and the incumbent party is punished. In this particular election, we have a unique situation. All of those models are post-war models, post-World War II models. In every single one of those elections, except for one, which was 1952, there was a president or a vice president on the ballot. And so you could hold accountable that party. It was very clear whose fault or whose credit the economic conditions should be given to. But this is a unique election. We have a true open seat election. There's not a president. There's not a vice president. That only happened three times in the 20th century, and here we have one in 2008.
Is that right? Only three times?
Only three times. There were two occasions in the 1920s, and one occasion in 1952. And some political scientists actually quibble about 1952 because Harry Truman actually did. Enter into the early part of the campaign process. He was eligible to seek re-election in 1952, but it was clear that he was going to have great difficulty even getting the nomination, and so he was so unpopular, he decided not to pursue re-election. So some people quibble that 52 wasn't truly an open seat election. I'm willing to say it was. But even if it was, even if it wasn't, this is a truly unique election in the sense that we don't have an incumbent president or an incumbent vice president on the ballot. And so I think the caller's point is well taken, which is it's different this time. You can imagine a lot of folks out there trying to decide between the two presidential candidates and not really factoring in that McCain or Obama should be credited with economic conditions and other kinds of things.
Mm-hmm. Thanks very much for the call. This brings us, of course, to Senator McCain's announcement anticipated for tomorrow for his vice presidential candidate and his statement that he's not, the economy is not really his strong suit, which will haunt him, I'm sure. Does he need somebody who will help him on the economy, or just as Biden was supposed to help Obama on foreign policy, or is that a meaningless announcement anyhow?
No, it's not meaningless. It'll help him probably if it's somebody that is viewed as strong on the economy. It's clear that that's not been McCain's strength. I don't think it's as important in McCain's situation as it has been for Obama's. Obama is a relative newcomer. He doesn't have long years of experience in certainly in Washington, but in elective politics more generally. So his the resumes are really quite different for the two. So Obama had more to try to deal with in terms of how the vice presidential selection would help him. McCain is a much better known quantity. He's been around for much longer. He probably needs to shore up his economic credentials with the vice presidential pick. All of that being said, in fact, the choice of the vice president rarely makes much difference. People vote for the presidential candidate. They don't generally look at the vice president and say, well, I like that person, so I'll go ahead and vote for the presidential candidate. They're looking at the top of the ticket by and large.
John from Milwaukee. Hi.
Hi, Kathleen and guest. My question is for you, and probably even could have been applicable to DJ Yon, is the life experiences of John McCain. I mean, he spares no event to wrap himself in his POW life experience, which was an experience of fate. Yet he's got such a pass from both critics, journalists, and Democrats on his life experience of choice, and that his involvement in corruption with the Keating Five and, you know, the loss of millions of dollars from savings and loans. And I'm just wondering why that is. Why does this not have been brought up in the media now? And I'll just listen to you off the air. Thank you.
Thank you, John.
Well, I think there are several reasons. One is McCain has been in public life for a lot longer, so the Keating Five scandal that happened back in the 1980s is so far in the past that I don't think it's as likely to be brought up as a current relevant contemporary piece of information. The other is that it was the Keating Five scandal that is what he credits with his turnaround in terms of campaign finance reform. So not only did he kind of admit to his embarrassment and shame in that process, but he built on it and in a way that is a kind of a classic story of forgiveness, or, you know, seeking forgiveness and then trying to do something about that. I think part of the reason that he's gotten a bit of a pass to this point is frankly that the Obama phenomenon has sucked so much oxygen toward the Democratic contest, and there's just been less attention toward the Republican contest. It wasn't contested nearly as long or as vociferously as the Democratic contest. And so the media stories, the media attention has really been much more heavily on Obama. It's, I think, frankly, in some ways more interesting for lots of people because of the historic nature of the candidacy. And so I think that that's happened. I think there's one other factor, which is that we haven't gotten to the Republican convention yet. I think the kind of Republican quick response to Democratic Party points during this week of the Democratic convention, we're going to see the same thing, but flipped around next week. The Democrats will be they'll have some sort of a situation room, or it'll be called something clever, no doubt, but in St. Paul, and they'll be trying to raise precisely these kinds of issues. And so next week is the week that reporters and the public will start paying more attention to the Republican contest.
Mm-hmm. Obviously, being a POW for that many years is a huge event in somebody's life, and it's worth mentioning. over and over again. There has been some criticism, Professor Bickers, as you well know, that too much attention has been centered on that part of Senator McCain's life and that he hasn't received the kind of examination that Senator Obama has. Is that a fair criticism, that we need to examine him more? Commentators need to look more carefully at his record, or is that not?
Well, I think it's a fair criticism, but some of those kinds of things, like Keating 5, were closely examined. I mean, mm-hmm. it's an issue of distance in the past and what has happened since. But I'd come back to the other point that I made, which is it's really just not even today, tomorrow, that people will start engaging the contest between Obama and McCain as opposed to Obama and Hillary Clinton,
right,
and so forth. And so I think that's going to happen. I just think we haven't seen it yet because we really haven't gotten to that phase of the campaign. But we have 2 months and change before the general election. And so I think there will be precisely those kinds of stories as reporters begin to look at both of the candidates more mm-hmm. closely.
Isn't it hard to believe when you said 2 months? I'm thinking, it's only 2 months. We've been talking about this forever.
It does seem like two decades.
Yeah, doesn't it?
But in fact, it's been 2 months.
And, right.
I mean, it'll only be 2 months. It's been 2 years that mm-hmm. this campaign has been going on. This is the longest presidential campaign in American history. We probably could have chopped off the first year and still be about where we are today. Mm-hmm. And I do think the public may be getting a little tired of it.
Mm-hmm. More phone calls in just one moment. Our guest this part of the show is Professor Kenneth Bickers. He's professor and chair of the Department of Political Science at the University of Colorado. Just a reminder, we have much more reaction to what was going on later on today. And also we will be carrying On Point, special program from 6 to 7, and then listen to the Democratic National Convention carried by National Public Radio here on our air starting at 7. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Returning to your phone calls now for Professor Kenneth Bickers, who joins us by phone from Colorado, where he says it's a beautiful day. Professor and chair of the Department of Political Science at the University of Colorado, did his PhD work at UW-Madison. Our next caller is Dawn from Appleton. Hi, Dawn.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Considering the historic nature of this election, I think it's important for us to recall that history also has a darker side, and in doing so, give a tremendous amount of credit to Senator Obama for something that's going entirely unnoticed. The fact that him going into Mile High tonight, which is a venue that, as hard as the Secret Service works, and I have immense trust in them, is going to have looser security, is incredibly courageous on his part, especially when you consider how early he started getting threats on his life during the campaign and how early he required Secret Service protection. I know I'm going to be holding my breath all the way through his speech, and I am just blown away by the bravery it is taking both of them to go up and stand in front of 75,000 people.
Well, that's the thing that was striking to me yesterday when I was listening to John Lewis, Professor Bickers, and others who were prominent in the civil rights movement. There's a long trail here. There was a lot of a lot of beating up of people. People have died for civil rights in this country. It's been hard, and I know a lot of people worry about his safety. But I guess you can't go there if you want to change things.
Well, I will say the security, as I understand it, is just exceptionally tight.
I'm sure
they're actually closing down the interstate that runs by Invesco Field, so there won't be any truck traffic passing by. They're doing that several hours beforehand. This is the major north-south artery through the city of Denver. It's an interstate, and so it'll inconvenience lots of people, but it's precisely so that they can ensure his safety and the safety of other people there. There's a absolute prohibition on air flight over the area. The security is apparently going to be exceptionally tight. So, the fear is there, and this, we've seen awful things happen. It's hard to think about this without thinking about Robert Kennedy's acceptance speech after the California primary back in 1968 when he was assassinated by Sirhan Sirhan, without worrying about the safety of Barack Obama. So, but best I can tell, everything I've heard, what I've seen, the Secret Service and all the law enforcement capacity in the area is taking extraordinary measures to ensure his safety this evening.
Mm-hmm. Thank you so much, Don, for the call. And what a shame that we even have to think about safety, right? I mean, there's so much in the world you can just wish you could do without. Yeah.
Well, I think the other thing to keep in mind, because that's clearly, you know, one side of it, the dark side, as Don mm-hmm. said. The bright side is that there will be 75,000 people cheering mm-hmm. at the top of their lungs, and most of those people will be white. There will be a diverse crowd, but it'll be a fairly white crowd in that stadium that's cheering him on, and I don't think the adulation is forced. I think it's genuine, it's real, and that's the 75,000 who are able to get tickets. There are lots of other folks who would love to be there. So I think in that 40 years since the assassination of Martin Luther King Jr. and Bobby Kennedy, America has changed and changed for the better in almost all respects.
Mm-hmm. Let's go next to Edith from Madison. Hi, Edith.
Oh, thank you, Kathleen. I just want to say that I have been totally blown away by the speakers last night and the night before, all of them. And I'm going to take exception with your guest over his characterization of Joe Biden's speech. I listen very carefully. Every night I have spent the entire 3 hours on my local PBS station paying attention to what the speaker said. Joe Biden took about every item of voting record of John McCain, and lambasted them. For example, John McCain voted against raising the minimum wage 19 times. That on issues of foreign policy and the war in Iraq and Afghanistan, every stand that John McCain has taken, Barack Obama had spoken up with a contrary opinion, and that in every case, Obama has been correct. That the Bush administration has chosen to change its policy and to follow what Barack Obama has been saying should happen. So I do believe that Biden nailed McCain and nailed the Bush administration and the Republican Party on just about every single issue of foreign policy and economics and corruption and everything. And I'm done.
Thanks very much for your call, Edith. Professor Biggers.
Oh, I think Biden's speech, in terms of what he said, was something that was well crafted. I mean, I think he had three things to do at least, and I think the speech did those things in a perfectly acceptable way. He needed to introduce himself, and that was part of what his son was doing for him to tell his story. I don't think many people that don't follow politics closely really knew the story of the way his first wife and one of his children was tragically killed, and so that part of the story is important. The other two tasks, he had to give reasons to vote for Barack Obama, and he had to give reasons not to vote for John McCain, and I think he did all of those things. My point was that his oratorical skills, the way he delivered the speech, wasn't up to the same level as Bill Clinton's, and no doubt will be outshone tonight by Barack Obama. But that should hardly be a surprise. Bill Clinton was president, and Barack Obama is the presidential candidate. Joe Biden is the vice presidential candidate. Not everybody has the same oratorical gifts. I think what the speech did was an important thing for a party to do, and that is the speeches at these conventions need to tell people why they should vote for their candidate and why they should not vote for the other candidate. I think the other thing he was trying to do, which it goes back to that point I was making to in response to one of your earlier callers, is trying to more self-consciously link in the general public's mind John McCain to the Bush administration. Because it's an open race, but the economy has been bad, and because people are dissatisfied with the war in Iraq and so forth, if the Democrats can successfully make McCain part of the Bush administration, if they can tie those two together in people's mind, and maybe the best line was Hillary Clinton's about the Twin Cities, so it's no surprise that McCain and Bush will be there together.
Yeah, we need to stop at this point because we are plumb out of time. Thank you. You've been a great guest. Thanks, Professor Biggers.
Sure.
Professor Kenneth Biggers, professor and chair of the Department of Political Science at the University of Colorado. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for doing such a wonderful job this week, and she will next week as we respond to the Republican National Convention. Thanks to John Treader for on-air production here in our studios in Milwaukee. I'm Kathleen Dunn. Thanks for your learned calls and questions.